about that. Elevator buttons as unrecognized sources of bacterial colonization in hospitals. For one of his studies, he had swabbed 120 elevator buttons and 96 toilet seats at three big Toronto hospitals and produced evidence that the elevator buttons were far more likely to infect you with some disease. But of all the bad things that happened to people in hospitals, the one that most preoccupied Rettelmeyer was clinical misjudgment. Doctors and nurses were human, too. They sometimes failed to see that the information patients offered them was unreliable. For instance, patients often said that they were feeling better and might indeed believe themselves to be improving when they had experienced no real change in their condition. Doctors tended to pay attention mainly to what they were asked to pay attention to and to miss some bigger picture. They sometimes failed to notice what they were not directly assigned to notice. One of the things Don taught me was the value of observing the room when the patient isn't there, says John Zapersky, chief of residence at Sunnybrook. Look at their meal tray. Did they eat? Did they pack for a long stay or a short one? Is the room messy or neat? Once, we walked into the room, and the patient was sleeping. I was about to wake him up, and Don stops me and says, "There is a lot you can learn about people from just watching." Doctors tended to see only what they were trained to see. That was another big reason bad things might happen to a patient inside a hospital. A patient received treatment for something that was obviously wrong with him from a specialist oblivious to the possibility that some less obvious thing might also be wrong with him. The less obvious thing, on occasion, could kill a person. The conditions of people mangled on the 401 were often so dire that the most obvious things wrong with them demanded the complete attention of the medical staff and immediate treatment. But the dazed young woman who arrived at the Sunnybrook emergency room directly from her head-on car crash, with her many broken bones, presented her surgeons, as they treated her, with a disturbing problem. The rhythm of her heartbeat had become wildly irregular. It was either skipping beats or adding extra beats. In any case, she had more than one thing seriously wrong with her. Immediately after the trauma center staff called Rettelmeyer to come to the operating room, they diagnosed the heart problem on their own, or thought they had. The young woman remained alert enough to tell them that she had a past history of an overactive thyroid. An overactive thyroid can cause an irregular heartbeat, and so, when Rettelmeyer arrived, the staff no longer needed him to investigate the source of the irregular heartbeat, but to treat it. No one in the operating room would have batted an eye if Rettelmeyer had simply administered the drugs for hyperthyroidism. Instead, Rettelmeyer asked everyone to slow down, to wait, just a moment, just to check their thinking, and to make sure they were not trying to force the facts into an easy, coherent, but ultimately false story. Something bothered him. As he said later, hyperthyroidism is a classic cause of an irregular heart rhythm, but hyperthyroidism is an infrequent cause of an irregular heart rhythm. Hearing that the young woman had a history of excess thyroid hormone production, the emergency room medical staff had leaped, with seeming reason, to the assumption that her overactive thyroid had caused the dangerous beating of her heart. They hadn't bothered to consider statistically far more likely causes of an irregular heartbeat. In Rettelmeyer's experience, doctors did not think statistically. 80% of doctors don't think probabilities apply to their patients, he said. Just like 95% of married couples don't believe the 50% divorce rate applies to them, and 95% of drunk drivers don't think the statistics that show that you are more likely to be killed if you are driving drunk than if you are driving sober applies to them. Rettelmeyer asked the emergency room staff to search for other, more statistically likely causes of the woman's irregular heartbeat. That's when they found her collapsed lung. Like her fractured ribs, her collapsed lung had failed to turn up on the X-ray. Unlike the fractured ribs, it could kill her. Rettelmeyer ignored the thyroid and treated the collapsed lung. The young woman's heartbeat returned to normal. The next day, her formal thyroid test came back. Her thyroid hormone production was perfectly normal. Her thyroid never had been the issue. It was a classic case of the representativeness heuristic, said Rettelmeyer. You need to be so careful when there is one simple diagnosis that instantly pops into your mind that beautifully explains everything all at once. That's when you need to stop and check your thinking. It wasn't that what first came to mind was always wrong. It was that its existence in your mind led you to feel more certain than you should be that it was correct. Beware of the delirious guy in the emergency unit with the long history of alcoholism, said Rettelmeyer, because you will say, He's just drunk, and you'll miss the subdural hematoma. The woman's surgeons had leapt from her medical history to a diagnosis without considering the base rates. As Kahneman and Tversky long ago had pointed out, a person who is making a prediction or a diagnosis is allowed to ignore base rates only if he is completely certain he is correct. Inside a hospital, or really any place else, Riddlemeyer was never completely certain about anything, and he didn't see why anybody else should be, either. Riddlemeyer had grown up in Toronto, in the same house in which his stockbroker father had been raised. The youngest of three boys, he often felt a little stupid. His older brothers always seemed to know more than he did and were keen to let him know it. Riddlemeyer also had a speech impediment, a maddening stammer he would never cease to work hard and painfully to compensate for. When he called for restaurant reservations, he just told them his name was Don Red. His stammer slowed him down when he spoke. His weakness as a speller slowed him down when he wrote. His body was not terribly well coordinated, and by the fifth grade he required glasses to correct his eyesight. His two great strengths were his mind and his temperament. He was always extremely good at math. He loved math. He could explain it, too, and other kids came to him when they couldn't understand what the teacher had said. That is where his temperament entered. He was almost peculiarly considerate of others. From the time he was a small child, grown-ups had noticed that about him. His first instinct upon meeting someone else was to take care of the person. Still, even from math class, where he often wound up helping all the other students, what he took away was a sense of his own fallibility. In math, there was a right answer and a wrong answer, and you couldn't fudge it. And the errors are sometimes predictable, he said. You see them coming a mile away, and you still make them. His experience of life as an error-filled sequence of events, he later thought, might be what had made him so receptive to an obscure article in the journal Science that his favorite high school teacher, Mr. Fleming, had given him to read in late 1977. He took the article home with him and read it that night at his desk. The article was called Judgment Under Uncertainty, Heuristics and Biases. It was in equal parts familiar and strange. What the hell was a heuristic? Riddlemeyer was 17 years old, and some of the jargon was beyond him. But the article described three ways in which people made judgments when they didn't know the answer for sure. The names the authors had given these, representativeness, availability, anchoring, were at once weird and seductive. They made the phenomenon they described feel like secret knowledge, and yet what they were saying struck Riddlemeyer as the simple truth, mainly because he was fooled by the questions they put to the reader. He, too, guessed that the guy they named Dick and described so blandly was equally likely to be a lawyer or an engineer, even though he came from a pool that was mostly lawyers. He, too, made a different prediction when he was given worthless evidence than when he was given no evidence at all. He, too, thought that there were more words in a typical passage of English prose that started with K than had K in the third position, because the words that began with K were easier to recall. He, too, made predictions about people from mere descriptions of them with a degree of confidence that was totally unjustified. Even uncertain Don Riddlemeyer fell prey to overconfidence. And when asked quickly to guess the product of 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times 6 times 7 times 8, he saw how he, too, would think it less than the product of 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. What struck Riddlemeyer wasn't the idea that people made mistakes. Of course people made mistakes. What was so compelling is that the mistakes were predictable and systematic. They seemed ingrained in human nature. Reading the article in Science reminded Riddlemeyer of all the times he had made what seemed in retrospect to be an obvious mistake on a math problem, because it was so much like the other mistakes he and others had made. One passage in particular stuck with him. It was in the section on this thing they called availability. It talked about the role of the imagination in human error. The risk involved in an adventurous expedition, for example, is evaluated by imagining contingencies with which the expedition is not equipped to cope, the authors wrote. If many such difficulties are vividly portrayed, the expedition can be made to appear exceedingly dangerous, although the ease with which disasters are imagined need not reflect their actual likelihood. Conversely, the risk involved in an undertaking may be grossly underestimated if some possible dangers are either difficult to conceive of or simply do not come to mind. This wasn't just about how many words in the English language started with the letter K. This was about life and death. "That article was more thrilling than a movie to me," said Rettelmeyer, "and I love movies." Rettelmeyer had never heard of the authors, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, though at the bottom of the page it said that they were members of the Department of Psychology at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. To him, it was more important that his older brothers had never heard of them either. "Aha! Finally! I know something more than my brothers," he thought. Kahneman and Tversky offered what felt like a private glimpse of the act of thinking. Reading their article was like getting a peek behind the magician's curtain. Rettelmeyer didn't have much trouble figuring out what he wanted to do with his life. As a kid, he'd fallen in love with the doctors on television, Leonard McCoy on Star Trek, and especially Hawkeye Pierce on MASH. "I sort of wanted to be heroic," he said. "I would never cut it in sports. I would never cut it in politics. I would never make it in the movies. Medicine was a path, a way to have a truly heroic life." He felt the pull so strongly that he applied to medical school at the age of 19 during his second year of college. Just after his 20th birthday, he was training at the University of Toronto to become a doctor. And that's where the problem started. The professors didn't have much in common with Leonard McCoy or Hawkeye Pierce. A lot of them were self-important and even a bit pompous. Something about them and what they were saying led Rettelmeyer to seditious thoughts. "Early on in medical school, there are a whole bunch of professors who are saying things that are wrong," he recalled. "I don't dare say anything about it. They repeated common superstitions as if they were eternal truths. Bad things come in threes." Specialists from different fields of medicine faced with the same disease offered contradictory diagnoses. His professor of urology told students that blood in the urine suggested a high chance of kidney cancer, while his professor of nephrology said that blood in the urine indicated a high chance of glomerulonephritis, kidney inflammation. Both had exaggerated confidence based on their expert experience, said Rettelmeyer, and both mainly saw only what they had been trained to see. The problem was not what they knew or didn't know. It was their need for certainty, or at least the appearance of certainty. Standing beside the slide projector, many of them did not so much teach as preach. "There was a generalized mood of arrogance," said Rettelmeyer. "What do you mean you didn't give steroids?" To Rettelmeyer, the very idea that there was a great deal of uncertainty in medicine went largely unacknowledged by its authorities. There was a reason for this. To acknowledge uncertainty was to admit the possibility of error. The entire profession had arranged itself as if to confirm the wisdom of its decisions. Whenever a patient recovered, for instance, the doctor typically attributed the recovery to the treatment he had prescribed, without any solid evidence that the treatment was responsible. "Just because the patient is better after I treated him doesn't mean he got better because I treated him," Rettelmeyer thought. "So many diseases are self-limiting," he said. "They will cure themselves. People who are in distress seek care. When they seek care, physicians feel the need to do something. You put leeches on, the condition improves, and that can propel a lifetime of leeches, a lifetime of overprescribing antibiotics, a lifetime of giving tonsillectomies to people with ear infections. You try it, and they get better the next day, and it is so compelling. You go to see a psychiatrist, and your depression improves. You are convinced of the efficacy of psychiatry." Rettelmeyer noticed other problems, too. His medical school professors took data at face value that should have been inspected more closely, for example. An old man would come into the hospital suffering from pneumonia. They'd check his heart rate and find it to be a reassuringly normal 75 beats per minute, and just move on. But the reason pneumonia killed so many old people was its power to spread infection. An immune system responding as it should generated fever, coughs, chills, sputum, and a faster-than-normal heartbeat. A body fighting an infection required blood to be pumped through it at a faster-than-normal rate. "The heart rate of an old man with pneumonia is not supposed to be normal," said Rettelmeyer. "It's supposed to be ripping along." An old man with pneumonia whose heart rate appears normal is an old man whose heart may well have a serious problem. But the normal reading on the heart rate monitor created a false sense in doctors' minds that all was well. And it was precisely when all seemed well that medical experts failed to check themselves. As it happens, a movement was taking shape right then and there in Toronto that came to be called evidence-based medicine. The core idea of evidence-based medicine was to test the intuition of medical experts, to check the thinking of doctors against hard data. When subjected to scientific investigation, some of what passed for medical wisdom turned out to be shockingly wrongheaded. When Rettelmeyer entered medical school in 1980, for instance, the conventional wisdom held that if a heart attack victim suffered from subsequent arrhythmia, you gave him drugs to suppress it. By the end of Rettelmeyer's medical training, 7 years later, researchers had shown that heart attack patients whose arrhythmia was suppressed died more often than the ones whose condition went untreated. No one explained why doctors for years had opted for a treatment that systematically killed patients, though proponents of evidence-based medicine were beginning to look to the work of Kahneman and Tversky for possible explanations. But it was clear that the intuitive judgments of doctors could be gravely flawed. The evidence of the medical trials now could not be ignored, and Rettelmeyer was alive to the evidence. I became very aware of the buried analysis, that a lot of the probabilities were being made up by expert opinion, said Rettelmeyer. I saw error in the way people think that was being transmitted to patients, and people had no recognition of the mistakes that they were making. I had a little unhappiness, a little dissatisfaction, a sense that all was not right in the state of Denmark. Toward the end of their article in Science, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky had pointed out that while statistically sophisticated people might avoid the simple mistakes made by less savvy people, even the most sophisticated minds were prone to error. As they put it, their intuitive judgments are liable to similar fallacies in more intricate and less transparent problems. That, the young Rettelmeyer realized, was a fantastic rationale why brilliant physicians were not immune to these fallibilities. He thought back to the errors he had made while trying to solve math problems. The same problem solving exists in medicine, he said. In math, you always check your work. In medicine, no. And if we are fallible in algebra, where the answers are clear, how much more fallible must we be in a world where the answers are much less clear? Error wasn't necessarily shameful, it was merely human. They provided a language and a logic for articulating some of the pitfalls people encounter when they think. Now these mistakes could be communicated. It was the recognition of human error, not its denial, not its demonization, just the understanding that they are part of human nature. But Rettelmeyer kept to himself any heretical thoughts he harbored as a young medical student. He had never felt the impulse to question authority or flout convention, and had no talent for either. I was never shocked and disappointed before in my life, he said. I was always very obedient, law-abiding. I vote in all elections. I show up at every university staff meeting. I've never had an altercation with the police. In 1985, he was accepted as a medical resident at the Stanford University Hospital. At Stanford, he began, haltingly, to voice his professional skepticism. One night during his second year, he was manning the intensive care unit and was assigned to keep a young man alive long enough to harvest his organs. The American euphemism, harvesting, sounded strange to his ears. In Canada, they called it organ retrieval. His brain-dead patient was a 21-year-old who had wrapped his motorcycle around a tree. It was the first time Rettelmeyer had been confronted with a dying body of a person younger than himself, and it bothered him in a way that the deaths of older people he had witnessed had not. It was such a loss of so many life years, he said. It was such a preventable case, and the guy hadn't been wearing a helmet. Rettelmeyer was newly struck by the inability of human beings to judge risks, even when their misjudgment might kill them. When making judgments, people obviously could use help, say by requiring all motorcyclists to wear helmets. Later, Rettelmeyer said as much to one of his fellow students, an American. What is it with you freedom-loving Americans, he asked. Live free or die? I don't get it. I say, regulate me gently. I'd rather live. His fellow student replied, not only do a lot of Americans not share your view, other physicians don't share your view. Rettelmeyer's fellow student told him about Stanford's famous head of cardiac surgery, Norm Shumway, who had actively lobbied against the creation of a law that would require motorcyclists to wear helmets. It dropped my jaw, said Rettelmeyer. How could a guy so smart be so stupid about that? We're definitely capable of errors, and human fallibility should be paid attention to. At the age of 27, as he finished his Stanford residency, Rettelmeyer was creating the beginnings of a worldview that internalized the article by the two Israeli psychologists that he had read as a teenager. Where this worldview would lead, he did not know. He still thought it possible that, upon his return to Canada, he might just move back up to Northern Labrador, where he had spent one summer during medical school delivering health care to a village of 500 people. "I didn't have great memory skills or great dexterity," he said. "I was afraid I wouldn't be a great doctor, and if I wasn't going to be great, I might as well go to serve someplace that was underserved, where I was needed and wanted." Redemeyer actually still believed that he might wind up practicing medicine in a conventional manner. But then he met Amos Tversky.
Redemeyer had long made a habit of anticipating his own mental errors and correcting for them. Alive to the fallibility of his memory, he carried a notepad wherever he went and wrote down thoughts and problems as they occurred to him. When awakened late at night by a phone call from the hospital, he always lied and told the fast-talking resident on the other end of the line that they had a bad connection, and so he needed to repeat everything he had just said. You can't tell a resident he is speaking too quickly. You blame yourself, and it facilitates not only his thinking but my own. When a visitor turned up in Redemeyer's office when he was between rounds, he would set a kitchen timer to make sure he didn't get lost in conversation and wind up late for his patients. "Redemeyer loses track of time when he is having fun," said Redemeyer. In advance of any social situation, he went to unusual lengths to correct whatever he imagined might go wrong. When he gave a talk, still a massive challenge for him with his stammer, he cased the lecture hall and simulated his entire performance. And so, in the spring of 1988, for Redemeyer, it felt perfectly normal, 2 days before his first lunch with Amos Tversky, to walk through the Stanford Faculty Club dining room where they were scheduled to meet. On the day of the lunch, he moved his hospital tour of patients from 6:30 in the morning to 4:30 to reduce the risk that anyone's medical problems would interfere with his meeting. He didn't eat breakfast usually, but on this day he did, so that he wouldn't be distracted by hunger during lunch. As was also his habit, he jotted down in advance little notes, potential topics of discussion, for fear of blanking. Not that he intended to say much. Hal Sox, Redemeyer's superior at Stanford, who would be joining them, had told Redemeyer, "Don't talk, don't say anything, don't interrupt, just sit and listen." Meeting with Amos Tversky, Hal Sox said, was like brainstorming with Albert Einstein. "He is one for the ages. There won't ever be anyone else like him." Hal Sox happened to have co-authored the first article Amos ever wrote about medicine. Their paper had sprung from a question Amos had put to Sox: how did a tendency people exhibited when faced with financial gambles play itself out in the minds of doctors and patients? Specifically, given a choice between a sure gain and a bet with the same expected value, say $100 for sure or a 50-50 shot at winning $200, Amos had explained to Hal Sox, people tended to take the sure thing, a bird in the hand. But given the choice between a sure loss of $100 and a 50-50 shot of losing $200, they took the risk. With Amos's help, Sox and two other medical researchers designed experiments to show how differently both doctors and patients made choices when those choices were framed in terms of losses rather than gains. Lung cancer proved to be a handy example. Lung cancer doctors and patients in the early 1980s faced two unequally unpleasant options, surgery or radiation. Surgery was more likely to extend your life, but unlike radiation, it came with the small risk of instant death. When you told people that they had a 90% chance of surviving surgery, 82% of patients opted for surgery. But when you told them that they had a 10% chance of dying from the surgery, which was, of course, just a different way of putting the same odds, only 54% chose the surgery. People facing a life-and-death decision responded not to the odds, but to the way the odds were described to them. And not just patients, doctors did it too. Working with Amos, Sox said, had altered his view of his own profession. The cognitive aspects are not at all understood in medicine, he said. Among other things, he could not help but wonder how many surgeons, consciously or unconsciously, had told some patient that he had a 90% chance of surviving a surgery, rather than a 10% chance of dying from it, simply because it was in his interest to perform the surgery. At that first lunch, Redemeyer mainly just watched as Sox and Amos talked. Still, he noticed some things. Amos's pale blue eyes darted around, and he had a slight speech impediment. His English was fluent, but spoken with a thick Israeli accent. He was a little bit hypervigilant, said Redemeyer. He was bouncy, energetic. He had none of the lassitude of some of the tenured faculty. He did 90% of the talking. Every word was worth listening to. I was surprised by how little medicine he knew, because he was already having a big effect on medical decision-making. Amos had all sorts of questions for the two doctors. Most of them had to do with probing for illogic in medical behavior. After watching Hal Sachs answer or try to answer Amos's questions, Rettelmeyer realized that he was learning more about his superior in a single lunch than he'd gathered from the previous 3 years. Amos knew exactly what questions to ask, said Rettelmeyer. There were no awkward silences. At the end of the lunch, Amos invited Rettelmeyer to visit him in his office. It didn't take long before Amos was bouncing ideas about the human mind off Rettelmeyer, as he had bounced them off Hal Sachs, to listen for an echo in medicine. The Samuelson bet, for instance. The Samuelson bet was named for Paul Samuelson, the economist who had cooked it up. As Amos explained it, people offered a single bet in which they have a 50-50 chance either to win $150 or lose $100, usually decline it. But if you offer those same people the chance to make the same bet 100 times over, most of them accept the bet. Why did they make the expected value calculation and respond to the odds being in their favor when they were allowed to make the bet 100 times, but not when they are offered a single bet? The answer was not entirely obvious. Yes, the more times you play a game with the odds in your favor, the less likely you are to lose, but the more times you play, the greater the total sum of money you stood to lose. Anyway, after Amos finished explaining the paradox, he said, "Okay, Rettelmeyer, find me the medical analogy to that." For Rettelmeyer, medical analogies popped quickly to mind. Whatever the general example was, I knew a bunch of instantaneous medical examples. It was just astonishing that he would shut up and listen to me. A medical analogy of Samuelson's bet, Rettelmeyer decided, could be found in the duality in the role of the physician. The physician is meant to be the perfect agent for the patient as well as the protector of society, he said. Physicians deal with patients one at a time, whereas health policymakers deal with aggregates. But there was a conflict between the two roles. The safest treatment for any one patient, for instance, might be a course of antibiotics. But the larger society suffers when antibiotics are overprescribed and the bacteria they were meant to treat evolved into versions of themselves that were more dangerous and difficult to treat. A doctor who did his job properly really could not just consider the interests of the individual patient. He needed to consider the aggregate of patients with that illness. The issue was even bigger than one of public health policy. Doctors saw the same illness over and again. Treating patients, they weren't merely making a single bet. They were being asked to make that same bet over and over again. Did doctors behave differently when they were offered a single gamble and when they were offered the same gamble repeatedly? The paper subsequently written by Amos with Rettelmeyer showed that in treating individual patients, the doctors behaved differently than they did when they designed ideal treatments for groups of patients with the same symptoms. They were likely to order additional tests to avoid raising troubling issues, and less likely to ask if patients wished to donate their organs if they died. In treating individual patients, doctors often did things they would disapprove of if they were creating a public policy to treat groups of patients with the exact same illness. Doctors all agreed that, if required by law, they should report the names of patients diagnosed with a seizure disorder, diabetes, or some other condition that might lead to a loss of consciousness while driving a car. In practice, they didn't do this, which could hardly be in the interest even of the individual patient in question. This result is not just another manifestation of the conflict between the interests of the patient and the general interests of society, Tversky and Rettelmeyer wrote in a letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. The discrepancy between the aggregate and the individual perspectives also exists in the mind of the physician. The discrepancy seems to call for a resolution. It is odd to endorse a treatment in every case and reject it in general, or vice versa. The point was not that the doctor was incorrectly or inadequately treating individual patients. The point was that he could not treat his patient one way, and groups of patients suffering from precisely the same problem in another way, and be doing his best in both cases. Both could not be right. And the point was obviously troubling, at least to the doctors who flooded the New England Journal of Medicine with letters written in response to the article. Most physicians try to maintain this facade of being rational and scientific and logical, and it's a great lie, said Rettelmeyer. A partial lie. What leads us is hopes and dreams and emotion. Rettelmeyer's first article with Amos led to other ideas. Soon they were meeting not in Amos's office in the afternoon, but at Amos's home late at night. Working with Amos wasn't work. It was pure joy, said Rettelmeyer. Pure fun. Rettelmeyer knew at some deep level that he was in the presence of a person who would change his life. Many sentences popped out of Amos's mouth that Rettelmeyer knew he would forever remember. A part of good science is to see what everyone else can see, but think what no one else has ever said. The difference between being very smart and very foolish is often very small. So many problems occur when people fail to be obedient when they are supposed to be obedient, and fail to be creative when they are supposed to be creative. The secret to doing good research is always to be a little underemployed. You waste years by not being able to waste hours. It is sometimes easier to make the world a better place than to prove you have made the world a better place. Rettelmeyer half suspected that the reason Amos had so much time for him was that Rettelmeyer was not married and was willing to treat the hours between midnight and 4 in the morning as part of a workday. The hours Amos kept were strange, but the discipline he imposed became familiar. He needs the concrete examples to test his general theories, said Rettelmeyer. Some of the principles were just extremely robust, and I was supposed to find examples and give voice to them in a particular domain, medicine. Amos had a clear idea of how people misperceived randomness, for instance. They didn't understand that random sequences seemed to have patterns in them. People had incredible ability to see meaning in these patterns where none existed. Watch any NBA game, Amos explained to Rettelmeyer, and you saw that the announcers, the fans, and maybe even the coaches seemed to believe that basketball shooters had the hot hand. Simply because some player had made his last few shots, he was thought to be more likely to make his next shot. Amos had collected data on NBA shooting streaks to see if the so-called hot hand was statistically significant. He already could persuade you that it was not. A better shooter was, of course, more likely to make his next shot than a less able shooter, but the streaks observed by fans and announcers and the players themselves were illusions. He asked Rettelmeyer to find in medicine the same sort of false pattern-seeking behavior exhibited by basketball announcers. Rettelmeyer soon returned with the widely held belief that arthritis pain was related to the weather. For thousands of years, people had imagined this connection. It could be traced back to Hippocrates, who wrote in 400 BC about the effect of wind and rain on disease. In the late 1980s, doctors were still suggesting to arthritis patients that they move to warmer climates. Working with Amos, Rettelmeyer found a large group of arthritis patients and asked them to report their pain levels. He then matched these to weather reports. Pretty quickly, he and Amos established that despite the patients' claims that their pain changed with the weather, there was no meaningful correlation between the two. They didn't stop there, however. Amos wanted to explain why people saw this connection between their pain and the weather. Rettelmeyer interviewed the patients whose pain he had proven to be unrelated to the weather. All but one of them still insisted that their pain was related to the weather and cited, as evidence, the few random moments that justified their belief. Basketball experts seized on random streaks as patterns in players' shooting that didn't exist. Arthritis sufferers found patterns in suffering that didn't exist. We attribute this phenomenon to selective matching, Tversky and Rettelmeyer wrote. For arthritis, selective matching leads people to look for changes in the weather when they experience increased pain, and pay little attention to the weather when their pain is stable. A single day of severe pain and extreme weather might sustain a lifetime of belief in a relation between them. There might not be a pattern in arthritis pain, but, to Rettelmeyer's eye, there appeared to be a very clear pattern in his collaboration with Amos. Amos had all these general ideas about the pitfalls in the human mind when it was required to render judgments in conditions of uncertainty. Their implications for medicine had gone pretty much entirely unexplored. Sometimes I felt Amos was pilot testing ideas in front of me, said Rettelmeyer, to see if they were germane to the real world. Rettelmeyer could not help but sense that medicine for Amos was just the tiniest little sliver of his interests. Another human activity in which to explore the specific consequences of the general ideas he had hatched with Danny Kahneman. Then Danny himself appeared. In late 1988, or maybe early 1989, Amos introduced them in his office. Danny followed up with a phone call to Rettelmeyer, in which he said how he, too, might like to explore how doctors and patients made decisions. It turned out that Danny had his own ideas, with their own implications. When he calls me, Danny is working alone, said Rettelmeyer. He wants to introduce another heuristic, one that is all his own, separate from Amos. The introduction of a fourth heuristic.
because there can't be just three.
One day in the summer of 1982, Danny, in his third year as a professor at the University of British Columbia, had walked into his lab and surprised his graduate students with an announcement. They'd now study happiness. Danny had always been curious about people's ability or inability to predict their feelings about their own experiences. Now he wanted to study it. Specifically, he wanted to explore the gap, he had sensed it in himself, between a person's intuitions about what made him happy and what actually made him happy. He thought he might start by having people guess how happy it would make them to come into the lab every day for a week and do something that they said they enjoyed. Eat a bowl of ice cream, say, or listen to their favorite song. He might then compare the pleasure they anticipated to the pleasure they experienced, and further compare the pleasure they experienced to the pleasure they remembered. There was clearly a difference to be explored, he argued. At the moment your favorite soccer team wins the World Cup, you are beyond elated. 6 months later, it means next to nothing to you, really. For a long time, there were no subjects involved, recalled Dale Miller, a graduate student of Danny's. He was just designing these experiments. What Danny imagined is that people wouldn't be especially good at predicting their own happiness, and his first experiments on a handful of subjects suggested he was onto something. A man whom no one would ever have described as happy was setting out, to the wonder of those who knew him, to discover the rules of happiness. Or maybe he was merely sowing doubt in the minds of people who thought they knew what it meant to be happy. At any rate, by the time Amos introduced him to Rettelmeyer, Danny had moved from the University of British Columbia to the University of California, Berkeley, and from happiness to unhappiness. He was now investigating not only the gap between people's anticipation of pleasure and their experience of pleasure, but also the gap between people's experience of pain and their memory of it. What did it mean if people's prediction of the misery that might be caused by some event was different from the misery they actually experienced when the event occurred? Or if people's memory of an experience turned out to be meaningfully different from the experiences that had actually played out. A lot, thought Danny. People had a miserable time for most of their vacation and then returned home and remembered it fondly. People enjoyed a wonderful romance, but because it ended badly, looked back on it mainly with bitterness. They didn't simply experience fixed levels of happiness or unhappiness. They experienced one thing and remembered something else. When he met Rettelmeyer, Danny was already running experiments on unhappiness in his Berkeley lab. He'd stick the bare arms of his subjects into buckets of ice water. Each subject was given two painful experiences. He'd then be asked which of the two experiences he'd most like to repeat. Funny things happened when you did this with people. Their memory of pain was different from their experience of it. They remembered moments of maximum pain, and they remembered especially how they felt the moment the pain ended. But they didn't particularly remember the length of the painful experience. If you stuck people's arms in ice buckets for 3 minutes but warmed the water just a bit for another minute or so before allowing them to flee the lab, they remembered the experience more fondly than if you stuck their arms in the bucket for 3 minutes and removed them at a moment of maximum misery. If you asked them to choose one experiment to repeat, they'd take the first session. That is, people preferred to endure more total pain so long as the experience ended on a more pleasant note. Danny wanted Rettelmeyer to find him a real-world medical example of what he was calling the peak-end rule. It didn't take long for Rettelmeyer to come up with a bunch, but they settled on colonoscopies. In the late 1980s, colonoscopies were painful and not merely dreaded. The discomfort of the procedure dissuaded people from returning for another one. By 1990, colon cancer was killing 60,000 people every year in the United States alone. Many of its victims would have survived had their cancer been detected at an early stage. One of the big reasons colon cancer went undetected was that people found their first colonoscopy so unpleasant that they elected not to return for a second one. Was it possible to alter their memory of the experience so that they might forget how unpleasant it was? To answer the question, Rettelmeyer ran an experiment on roughly 700 people over a period of a year. One group of patients had the colonoscope yanked out of their rear ends at the end of their colonoscopy without ceremony. The other group felt the tip of the scope lingering in their rectums for an extra 3 minutes. Those extra 3 minutes were not pleasant. They were merely less unpleasant than the other procedure. The patients in the first group were on the receiving end of an old-fashioned wham-bam-thank-you-ma'am colonoscopy. Those in the second group enjoyed a sweeter or less painful ending. The sum total of pain experienced by the second group was, however, greater, The patients in the second group experienced all the pain that those in the first group experienced, plus the extra 3 minutes worth. An hour after the procedure, the researchers entered the recovery room and asked the patients to rate their experience. Those who had been given the less unhappy ending remembered less pain than did the patients who had not. More interestingly, they proved more likely to return for another colonoscopy when the time came. Human beings who had never imagined that they might prefer more pain to less could nearly all be fooled into doing so. As Riddlemeyer put it, last impressions can be lasting impressions. Working with Danny was different from working with Amos. Riddlemeyer's mental picture of Amos was always crystal clear. Danny left behind a more complicated and murkier impression. Danny was not joyful. Danny was maybe even depressed. He suffered for his work, and so those who worked with him inevitably suffered a bit, too. He was more likely to see what was wrong with the work and less likely to see what was right with it, said Riddlemeyer. And yet, what came out of his mind was also, obviously, spectacular. It was odd, when Riddlemeyer stopped to think about it, how little he ever learned about Amos's and Danny's lives. Amos told me very, very little about his life, he said. He never talked about Israel, he never talked about the wars, he didn't talk about the past. It's not that he was deliberately evasive, it's just that he controlled the agenda. The agenda, when they were together, was to analyze human behavior in the delivery of health care. He didn't presume to ask Danny or Amos about their past or their relationship to each other. And so he never found out how or why they had left Hebrew University and Israel for North America, or why Amos had spent the 1980s as an exalted chaired professor of behavioral science at Stanford, while Danny passed most of that time in relative obscurity at the University of British Columbia. The two men seemed friendly enough, but they weren't obviously working together. Why was that? Riddlemeyer didn't know. And they wouldn't talk about each other, he said. Instead, they seemed to have decided they'd bag more game if they hunted separately rather than together. Both were engaged, in different ways, in extending the ideas that they had given birth to jointly in the real world. I was thinking they were just buddies, and I was their pet schnauzer, said Riddlemeyer. Riddlemeyer returned to Toronto in 1992. The experience working with Amos had been life-altering. The man was so vivid that you could not confront any question without wondering how he would approach it. And yet, as Amos always seemed to have all the big ideas and simply needed medical examples to illustrate them, Riddlemeyer was left with the feeling that maybe he hadn't done very much. In many ways, I was a glorified secretary, and that troubled me for many years, he said. Deep down, I thought I was extremely replaceable. When I came back to Toronto, I wondered, was it just Amos, or was there something Riddlemeyer? Still, only a few years earlier, he'd imagined that he might wind up a general practitioner in a small village in northern Labrador. Now he had a particular ambition, to explore, as both researcher and doctor, the mental mistakes that doctors and their patients made. He wanted to combine cognitive psychology, as practiced by Danny and Amos, with medical decision-making. How exactly he would do this, he could not immediately say. He was still too unsure of himself. All he knew for sure was that by working with Amos Tversky, he had discovered this other side to himself, a seeker of truth. He wanted to use data to find true patterns in human behavior, to replace the false ones that govern people's lives and, often, their deaths. I didn't really know what was in there, Riddlemeyer said of this side of himself. Amos doesn't uncover it. He implants it. He sends me as a messenger to a land in the future that he will never see. Chapter 9. Birth of the Warrior Psychologist. By the fall of 1973, it was fairly clear to Danny that other people would never fully understand his relationship with Amos. The previous academic year, they taught a seminar together at Hebrew University. From Danny's point of view, it had been a disaster. The warmth he felt when he was alone with Amos vanished whenever Amos was in the presence of an audience. When we were with other people, we were one of two ways, said Danny. Either we finished each other's sentences and told each other's jokes, or we were competing. No one ever saw us working together. No one knows what we were like. What they were like in every way but sexually was lovers. They connected with each other more deeply than either had connected with anyone else. Their wives noticed it. Their relationship was more intense than a marriage, said Barbara. I think they were both turned on intellectually more than either had ever been before. It was as if they were both waiting for it. Danny sensed that his wife felt some jealousy. Amos actually praised Barbara, behind her back, for dealing so gracefully with the intrusion on their marriage.
"Just to be with him," said Danny. "I never felt that way with anyone else, really. You're in love and things, but I was rapt. And that's what it was like. It was truly extraordinary."
And yet it was Amos who worked hardest to find ways to keep them together.
"I was the one who was holding back," said Danny. "I kept my distance because I was afraid of what would happen to me without him."
It was 4 in the morning California time when the armies of Egypt and Syria launched their attack upon Israel. They had taken the Israelis by surprise on Yom Kippur. Along the Suez Canal, the 500-man Israeli garrison was overwhelmed by 100,000 Egyptian troops. From the Golan Heights, 177 Israeli tank crews gazed down upon an attacking force of 2,000 Syrian tanks. Amos and Danny, still in the United States trying to become decision analysts, raced to the airport and got the first flight possible to Paris, where Danny's sister worked in the Israeli embassy. Getting into Israel during a war wasn't easy. Every inbound LL plane was crammed with fighter pilots and combat unit commanders who were coming in to replace the men killed in the first days of the invasion. "That's just what you did if you were an Israeli capable of fighting in 1973. You ran toward the war." Knowing this, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat had promised to shoot down any commercial planes attempting to land in Israel. As they waited in Paris for Danny's sister to talk someone into letting them onto a flight, Danny and Amos bought combat boots. They were made of canvas, lighter than the leather boots issued by the Israeli military. When the war broke out, Barbara Tversky was on the way to an emergency room in Jerusalem with her eldest son. He had won a contest with his brother to see who could stick a cucumber farthest up his own nose. As they headed home, people surrounded their car and screamed at Barbara for being on the road. The country was in a state of panic. Fighter jets screamed low over Jerusalem to signal all reserves to return to their units. Hebrew University closed. Army trucks rumbled all night through the Tversky's usually tranquil neighborhood. The city was black. Street lamps remained off. Anyone who owned a car taped over its brake lights. The stars could not have been more spectacular, or the news more troubling, because, for the first time, Barbara sensed that the Israeli government was withholding the truth. This war was different from the others. Israel was losing. Not knowing where Amos was or what he planned to do didn't help. Phone calls were so expensive that when he was in the United States, they communicated only by letter. Her situation wasn't unusual. There were Israelis who had learned that loved ones living abroad had returned to Israel to fight, only by being informed that they had been killed in action. To make herself useful, Barbara went to the library and found the material to write a newspaper article about stress and how to cope with it. A few nights into the conflict, around 10 o'clock, she heard footsteps. She was working alone in the study, with the blinds lowered to avoid letting the light seep out. The kids were asleep. Whoever was coming up the stairs was running. Then suddenly Amos bounded from the darkness. The LL flight that he had taken with Danny had carried as passengers no one but Israeli men returning to fight. It had descended into Tel Aviv in total darkness. There hadn't even been a light on the wing. Once again, Amos went into the closet and pulled down his army uniform, now with a captain's insignia on it, and once again, it fit. At 5 o'clock the following morning, he left. He had been assigned with Danny to the psychology field unit. The unit had grown since the mid-1950s when Danny had redesigned the selection system. In early 1973, an American psychologist named James Lester, sent by the Office of Naval Research to study Israeli military psychology, wrote a report in which he described the unit they were about to join. Lester marveled at the entire society, a country that had at once the world's strictest driving tests and the world's highest automobile accident rates, but seems to have been struck especially by the faith the Israeli military placed in their psychologists. "Failure rate in the officer course is running at 15 to 20%," he wrote. "Such confidence does the military have in the mysteries of psychological research that they are asking the selection section to try to identify these 15% during the first week in training." The head of Israeli military psychology, Lester reported, was an oddly powerful character named Benny Shalit. Shalit had argued for and received a new elevated status for military psychology. His unit had a renegade quality to it. Shalit had gone so far as to sew an insignia of his own design onto its uniform. "It consisted of the Israeli olive branch and sword," Lester explained,
topped by an eye which symbolizes assessment, insight, or something along those lines. In his attempts to turn his psychology unit into a fighting force, Shalit had dreamed up ideas that struck even the psychologists as wacko. Hypnotizing Arabs and sending them to assassinate Arab leaders, for instance. He actually did hypnotize one Arab, recalled Daniela Gordon, who served under Shalit in the psychology unit. They took him to the Jordanian border and he just ran off. A rumor among Shalit's subordinates, and it refused to die, was that Shalit kept the personality assessments made of all the Israeli military big shots, back when they were young men entering the army, and let them know that he wouldn't be shy about making them public. Whatever the reason, Benny Shalit had an unusual ability to get his way in the Israeli military, and one of the unusual things Shalit had asked for and received was the right to embed psychologists in army units where they might directly advise commanders. Field psychologists are in a position to make recommendations on a variety of unconventional issues, Lester reported to his U.S. Navy superiors. For example, one noticed that infantry troops in hot weather stopping to open soft drinks with their ammunition magazines often damaged the stock. It was possible to redesign the stock so that a tool for opening bottles was included. Shalit's psychologists had eliminated the unused sights on submachine guns and changed the way machine gun units worked together to increase the rate at which they fired. Psychologists in the Israeli army were, in short, off the leash. Military psychology is alive and well in Israel, concluded the United States Navy's reporter on the ground. It is an interesting question whether or not the psychology of the Israelis is becoming a military one. What Benny Shalit's field psychologists might do during an actual battle, however, was unclear. The psychology unit did not have the faintest idea what to do, said Eli Fischoff, who served as Benny Shalit's second in command. The war was totally unexpected. We were just thinking maybe it's the end of us. In a matter of days, the Israeli army had lost more men, as a percentage of the population, than the United States military lost in the entire Vietnam War. The war was later described by the Israeli government as a demographic disaster because of the prominence and talent of the Israelis who were killed. In the psychology unit, someone came up with the idea of designing a questionnaire to determine what, if anything, might be done to improve the morale of the troops. Amos seized upon it, helped to design the questions, and then used the entire exercise, more or less, as an excuse to get himself closer to the action. We just got a jeep and went bouncing around in the Sinai looking for something useful to do, said Danny. Their fellow psychologists, who watched Danny and Amos toss rifles into the back of a jeep and set out for the battlefield, thought they were out of their minds. Amos was so excited, like a little child, recalled Yaffa Singer. But it was crazy for them to go to the Sinai. It was so dangerous. It was absolutely crazy to send them out with those questionnaires. The risk of running directly into enemy tanks and planes was the least of it. There were landmines everywhere. It was easy to get lost. They didn't have guards, said Daniela Gordon, their commanding officer. They guarded themselves. All of them felt less concerned for Amos than for Danny. We were very worried about sending Danny on his own, said Eli Fischoff, head of the field psychologists. I wasn't so worried about Amos, because Amos was a fighter. The moment Danny and Amos were in the jeep roaring through the Sinai, however, it was Danny who became useful. He was jumping off the car and grilling people, recalled Fischoff. Amos seemed like the practical one, but Danny, more than Amos, had a gift for finding solutions to problems where others failed even to notice that there was a problem to solve. As they sped toward the front lines, Danny noticed the huge piles of garbage on the roadsides, the leftovers from the canned meals supplied by the U.S. Army. He examined what the soldiers had eaten and what they had thrown out. They liked the canned grapefruit. His subsequent recommendation that the Israeli army analyze the garbage and supply the soldiers with what they actually wanted made newspaper headlines. Israeli tank drivers were just then being killed in action at an unprecedented rate. Danny visited the site where new tank drivers were being trained as quickly as possible to replace the ones who had died. Groups of four men took turns in two-hour shifts on a tank. Danny pointed out that people learn more efficiently in short bursts, and that new tank drivers might be educated faster if the trainees rotated behind the wheel every 30 minutes. He also somehow found his way to the Israeli Air Force. Fighter pilots were also dying in unprecedented numbers because of Egypt's use of new and improved surface-to-air missiles provided by the Soviet Union. One squadron had suffered especially horrific losses. The general in charge wanted to investigate and possibly punish the unit. I remember him saying accusingly that one of the pilots had been hit not only by one missile, but by four, as if that was conclusive evidence of his ineptitude, recalled Danny. Danny explained to the general that he had a sample-size problem. The losses experienced by the supposedly inept fighter squadron could have occurred by random chance alone. If he investigated the unit, he would no doubt find patterns in behavior that might serve as an explanation. Perhaps the pilots in that squadron had paid more visits to their families, or maybe they wore funny-colored underpants. Whatever he found would be a meaningless illusion, however. There weren't enough pilots in the squadron to achieve statistical significance. On top of it, an investigation implying blame would be horrible for morale. The only point of an inquiry would be to preserve the general's feelings of omnipotence. The general listened to Danny and stopped the inquiry. "I've considered that my only contribution to the war effort," said Danny. The actual business at hand, putting questions to soldiers fresh from combat, Danny found pointless. Many of the soldiers were traumatized. "We were wondering what to do with people who were in shock, how even to evaluate them," said Danny. "Every soldier was frightened, but there were some people who couldn't function. Shell-shocked Israeli soldiers resembled people with depression. There were some problems Danny didn't feel equipped to deal with, and this was one of them. He didn't really want to be in the Sinai anyway, not in the way Amos seemed to want to be there. "I remember a sense of futility that we were wasting our time there," he said. When their jeep bounced once too often and caused Danny's back to go out, he quit the journey and left Amos alone to administer the questionnaires. From their jeep rides, he retained a single vivid memory. "We went to sleep near a tank," he recalled, "on the ground, and Amos didn't like where I was sleeping because he thought the tank might move and crush me, and I remember being very, very touched by this. It was not sensible advice, a tank makes a lot of noise, but that he was worried about me." Later, the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research undertook a study of the war. "Battle shock casualties during the 1973 Arab-Israeli War," it was called. The psychiatrist who prepared the report noted that the war was unusual in its intensity. It was fought 24 hours a day, at least at the start, and in the losses suffered. The report also noted that, for the first time, Israeli soldiers were diagnosed with psychological trauma. The questionnaires Amos had helped to design asked the soldiers many simple questions. Where were you? What did you do? What did you see? Was the battle a success? If not, why? People started to talk about fear, recalls Yaffa Singer, about their emotions. From the War of Independence until 1973, it hadn't been allowed. "We are supermen. No one has the guts to talk about fear. If we talk about it, maybe we won't survive." For days after the war, Amos sat with Singer and two other colleagues in the psychology field unit and read through the soldiers' answers to his questions. They spoke of their motives for fighting. "It's such horrible information that people tend to bury it," said Singer. But caught fresh, the soldiers revealed to the psychologists sentiments that, in retrospect, seemed blindingly obvious. "We asked, why is anyone fighting for Israel?" said Singer. "Until that moment, we were just patriots. When we started reading the questionnaires, it was so obvious. They were fighting for their friends or for their families, not for the nation, not for Zionism." At the time, it was a huge realization. Perhaps for the first time, Israeli soldiers spoke openly of their feelings, as they watched five of their beloved platoon mates blown to bits, or as they saw their best friend on earth killed because he turned left when he was supposed to turn right. "It was heartbreaking to read them," said Singer. Right up until the fighting stopped, Amos sought risks that he didn't need to take, that in fact others thought were foolish to take. "He decided to witness the end of the war along the Suez," recalled Barbara, "even though he knew full well that shelling continued after the time of the ceasefire." Amos's attitude toward physical risk occasionally shocked even his wife. Once he announced that he wanted to start jumping out of airplanes again, just for fun. "I said, 'You are the father of children,'" said Barbara. That ended the discussion. Amos wasn't a thrill-seeker exactly, but he had strong, almost childlike passions that every so often he allowed to grab hold of him and take him places most people would never wish to go. In the end, he crossed the Sinai to the Suez Canal. Rumors circulated that the Israeli army might march all the way to Cairo and that Soviets were sending nuclear weapons to Egypt to prevent them from doing so. Arriving at the Suez, Amos found that the shelling hadn't merely continued, it had intensified.
It was now a long-standing tradition on both sides of any Arab-Israeli war of seizing the moment